After 14 years, the UK's Labour Party is back in power. The Conservative Party suffered a dramatic collapse in its vote, losing 250 seats and giving Labour the majority. So, what happened and what comes next? That's our topic this week. I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Welcome to Put Simply. And welcome to this episode of Put Simply, where we're chatting all things UK politics, an incredible result for Labour and a humiliating one for the Conservatives. The pollsters got it just about right, but it was on the backdrop of the lowest voter turnout since the 19th century. So what does this all mean? And what are the implications across the UK for the Conservatives, for Labour, and for the next few years? Our guest this week is Rodney McCune. Rodney's a public affairs and communications professional who has advised governments and companies across Europe, Middle East, and Southeast Asia. He's our guest this week here on Put Simply.
Welcome back to Put Simply, Rodney. Great to have you with us to dig deeper into what is a historic election result coming out of the UK late last week. Before we get started, could you remind our listeners who you are and what it is that you do?
Sure, Ozan. Obviously, nice to talk to you guys again. I guess most importantly, I'm an elections nerd. I've been involved in UK politics for over 25 years, running campaigns as a candidate. But with fewer losses than Nigel Farage racked up before he finally got elected this time around. And I'm sure he's someone we'll come back to talk about during the course of this discussion. I've been a UK government ministerial advisor, and these days I provide strategic policy and communications advice to ministers in national and regional governments across Asia, where I'm currently based and have been for the last 8 years. And although I'm in Asia, the time difference for this UK election was absolutely perfect, and I was able to have a very nice day on Friday watching the results roll in.
So before we get into the results, can you put simply for us how the elections in the UK work? How do they elect their representatives? And how do they actually elect the government?
Sure. So in the UK, we elect 650 MPs. And the political party who secures the majority of MPs is asked to form the next government. Coalitions are very rare in the UK because of the electoral system. I think we've had three in the last 100 years, and two of those were unity governments during the Second World War. Our system is a first-past-the-post electoral system, and this is really important when you dig into the details of this particular election result. You sort of need to visualise the UK as one large mosaic jigsaw of an electoral map with contests within each one of those pieces of the jigsaw on our 650 constituencies across England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales have one MP elected per jigsaw piece. And first past the post means the candidate with the most votes within any constituency wins that seat. There are no transfers, no proportional representation, no second round. It's one race and one winner. So the winning vote share within a constituency can be quite low. I think the lowest vote share of any winning candidate in UK parliamentary history is still 24.5% within a constituency. And it was in South Belfast in 2015, which I know as I was a candidate in that constituency in that election, unfortunately not the winning candidate. And then following the totaling up of the number of seats across those 650 mini jigsaw piece contests, we have what I think most people quite like, which is orderly and swift transition. The morning after the election, the removal vans turn up at Downing Street. The outgoing PM and Prime Minister, in this case, it was Rishi Sunak, goes to Buckingham Palace to resign as Prime Minister. And then King Charles, a few hours later, invites Keir Starmer, in this case, the Labour Party leader and the winning candidate, went to see Prince Charles to accept the invitation to form the new government. He then goes to number 10 Downing Street, moves into Rishi's old house, becomes his new residence, and he appoints his ministers from his Labour MPs and peers being members of the House of Lords, which he can also select government ministers from, and gets down to business. And of course, that will be, and again, maybe come back to this, There will be a Keynes speech next week, which will set out the legislative agenda for the government over the next 12 months. Parliament will be recalled following that, and then they will go on recess, but that will probably not be now until late July, so they look active. I think we would all agree that the worst thing that could happen for a new government is to recall Parliament, go into recess, and look like they've just gone on holiday after the election.
Let's look at the results now, Rodney. A historic and convincing win for the Labour Party after 14 years of Conservative rule. While it wasn't a huge surprise, the polls had been suggesting, of course, a landslide for months. Can you explain to us what happened? Why did the Conservatives lose so badly, and why did Labour win so incredibly?
So if you look at the data, Labour got 412 of the 650 seats. So it's 63% of the seats with only 34% of the national vote share. The Conservatives are on 121 seats with 19% of the vote. And the Liberal Democrats, which is the third party in UK politics, got a remarkable 72 seats. And they were up from 9 seats in 2019. It's their best result in a century, even going back through the old Liberal Party. But again, on pretty modest vote share. The landslide part is the Labour majority, which is 174 seats, which is just shy of the Blair majority in 97. But it's the electoral system that delivers that particular type of outcome from a smaller vote share. And that's why I pointed out about the first-past-the-post system earlier, because within different constituencies, people who want the Conservatives out, and that is a factor in this election, will have gone for the candidate with the next best opportunity to remove a Conservative. And that's why we see the Lib Dems doing particularly well in certain areas of the country where they had previously been in second place in certain seats. But if we look more broadly, there are three factors. One is the government and their record. They've been in power for 14 years and five prime ministers, Cameron, May, Johnson, Truss, and then Sunak. Cameron was first in with the Lib Dems in a coalition. So one of those rare sort of three events within the last 100 years. He, in his first term, they had the Scottish referendum on independence. And from the Conservative position, they won that with the Scottish electorate rejecting independence. I think maybe the only country in history to have rejected independence. But following the 2015 election, having gone in with a promise to have a further referendum on the European Union, we had the issue of Brexit, which is, of course, one that provided a great deal of toxicity over the remaining term of the Conservative period in government. Theresa May failed to get Brexit done and get bogged down in negotiations and the form of Brexit. She then succeeded Cameron, didn't last particularly long, was replaced by Boris Johnson, popular but chaotic, undone to an extent through Partygate during the COVID period, when the rules were not applied to him and some of his colleagues in Downing Street who were having social events and breach of rules that were applied to the rest of the population. And he was also desperately economical with the truth on a pretty industrial scale and most of the other things that he did. So he then proved to be a pretty much amusing, but ultimately lacking in credibility, trust, etc. They then replaced him with Liz Truss, who lasted perhaps 6 weeks, brought out a mini budget that wasn't costed, which caused a sharp decline in the value of the pound. I think an all-time low against the US dollar. She sacked her chancellor 4 weeks in, and the replacement chancellor, which is the finance minister in the UK, reversed the policy and she was gone after 6 weeks. And that particular event broke the electorate's confidence that the Conservatives were always good for the economy, which is something even during periods of unpopularity, they were always able to rely on. Sunak, never really going to rescue the situation, but he also lacked an ability to relate to people. And he was seen as detached, independently wealthy during the election campaign. I'll mention that briefly. He was referred to as a caller into one interview show where he opened him up to live questions as someone who was better off than the Keane or wealthier than the Keane. And of course, his wife has tremendous family wealth. So it wasn't completely untrue. That sort of his position was it was always going to be challenging. But we look at poverty, no reduction in 14 years. Child poverty has increased, particularly children in larger families. Half of them are in poverty. Universal credit, not hugely successful. Working poverty has increased in the UK. Access in terms of property, home ownership is challenging because of house prices, access to finance, wages not keeping pace. Rent is particularly high in the south of England. Property prices and ownership rates, 2010 levels, not improved. Spending on education, again, not really moved on since 2010. And capital investment in schools is very poor. National debt, 2024 is 90% of GDP compared with 70% in 2010. There's a huge challenges within the health service that they never came to terms with. UK has a national health service, which is free at the point of entry, but appointments are triple the waiting time as they were in 2010, and so on and so on. And then even within their own base, despite the challenges around Brexit, they also were perceived to have failed on immigration, which is something which the Tories were expected to make progress on and tackle. And although it's not the biggest issue in terms of the electorate, it is one of the top two or three issues with older people, many of whom who are traditionally conservative voters. So they had very few successes. They had some successes around renewable energy and progress from the shift to renewable energy. But overall, on a lot of areas, health, education, the economy, the Conservatives weren't seen ultimately to have been particularly successful. And then we had the campaign. Rishi Sunak, not particularly good in terms of being relatable to people, launched his campaign as a surprise to his own party in the rain in Downing Street, with a stereo playing at the other end of Downing Street, quite audibly during his announcement of Things Can Only Get Better, which is a particular song that New Labour used in 97 as their election campaign song. He then went into national service and a raft of other announcements during the campaign, which begged the question, you've been in power 14 years, why haven't you done any of this before? He was asked about, on the relatability point and how he understands the experience of people, what he missed out on as a child, and he came up with Sky Television, which was derided by the media and public. He left the D-Day celebrations or commemorations early to go back to ITV to do an interview where he in fact mentioned that Sky issue. And he was viewed to have caused great offence to those who served in the armed forces, in particular those during World War II, and he never recovered credibility on that. That certainly played into the hands of people like Farage and Reform. He had a gambling scandal during the campaign where at least one of his candidates and campaign manager of part of the national campaign, who was the spouse or the partner of that particular candidate, had both placed bets on the date of the election. Not huge sums of money, but it was perceived as insider dealing in a way that they had inside information on the actual date of the election before they placed the bet. Now, this is subject to an ongoing investigation by the Gambling Commission in the UK, but the mood and the perception of the fact of that investigation didn't really do the Conservatives any favour. And he took an awful long time to deal with it. So he kept those candidates for a number of days longer than he needed to. And of course, he should and could have jettisoned them much earlier on when this story broke, just to clear it and get on with focus on the election campaign itself. And I guess the other factor is people simply wanted the Conservatives out. I'm not sure it would have mattered what they did or said during this election campaign. Yes, the Reform Party took from and in a sense broke their base, particularly around immigration and so on. And it was what the Conservatives had managed to do to Labour in 2019 by what they call as the Red Wall, which is strong Labour territory in the north of England, through getting the Brexit Done campaign under Johnson, had flipped people who were traditionally Labour voters on the issue of getting Brexit done to the Conservative Party. those constituencies don't feel the Conservatives did anything for them and flip back at this election. But within traditional Conservative constituencies, reform through on issues like immigration, like not honouring Brexit properly or failing to achieve the Brexit dividend, did something similar to the Tories. This time round, the Tories being the Conservative Party, as they had done to Labour the previous time. So a lot of this was an anti-Conservative vote, which is why we see so many parties, other parties having their vote share and number of seats increase as a result of the rather catastrophic Conservative decline at this election. So the number of beneficiaries really point to the fact that it was an anti-Conservative vote as much as a pro-Labour vote or a pro-Liberal Democrat vote or whatever, across the smaller parties as well. The Greens got an increase in terms of number of seats, reform too.
It was certainly fascinating to watch. I mean, we've all been involved in election campaigns, but I was gobsmacked to see some of the just basic mistakes that they had made. It really was amateur hour, I think. It really seemed like that. Almost, it seemed like Rishi Sunak had enough of the job and was doing everything he could to lose the campaign. But look, that aside, you mentioned the red wall. We saw some interesting results across the UK. Could you dig a little bit deeper into those? And also, what does this mean for the Conservatives? I mean, they seem to have lost the trust of those communities around the what's called the Red Wall, Northern England, the Midlands. They seem to have lost quite a bit of the confidence of the traditional Conservative segments of the population, and that's gone to reform. They've almost been wedged out of political relevance, in my opinion. What do you think about that? I mean, is there a future for the Conservative Party?
100% there's a future for the Conservative Party, but they've been reduced once again to an English-only, in effect, party. They don't have any elected members of Parliament in Northern Ireland, but Northern Ireland's a particular case. But even in Scotland, you look at Labour, this is where Labour had probably their greatest success in terms of increase in points. They're up 17 points. Largely at the expense of the Scottish National Party, which went from 39 seats to 9 seats. That's as spectacular, if not more spectacular, than the collapse of the Conservative Party at this election, where Labour were up from 1, I think, seat to about 36, 37 seats. And there's no real challenge from the Reform Party in Scotland, which is an interesting feature as well. So Scotland, we see huge return to Labour, primarily driven by Labour being the vehicle to get the Conservatives out. People departing the Scottish National Party going to Labour. There was slight gains for the Liberal Democrats. Labour have gone up in Wales from 9 to 27 seats. Conservatives have been wiped out. And that's why I say they're really back to being an English-only party. But even within England, the movement of the seats from Conservative to Labour, very clear in the north, very clear in London. But the south, slightly different picture, because in the south we see the loss of Conservative seats being evenly distributed between Labour and the Liberal Democrats. The real challenge for the Conservative Party is what does it do next? Now, in part, the next leader will be a big choice. The temptation for the Conservative Party will be to move to the right in order to try and reconnect with that component of their base that's moved to reform. But in doing so, they're going to vacate the middle ground further for Labour. And ultimately, when you look back at when the Conservatives went round in a circle to come back and although it was a coalition government in 2010, but to take power back from New Labour, they did so with a centrist Conservative leader in David Cameron. Prior to that, they had a succession of leaders with William Hague and Duncan Smith, Michael Howard, and so on, who were all considered to be further to the right, and they had to go through a number of iterations of leadership in order to find themselves back in the position that they had to attract voters from the centre in order to take from New Labour. Now, the Conservatives will have to look within their 121 MPs to see who those candidates are to succeed. Sunak, who will stay on as leader, I'm guessing, or I'm presuming, until an orderly transition or leadership contest can be undertaken. But part of that discussion for the Conservatives will be, should they return the choice of leader to the parliamentary party, where they've previously taken it from the parliamentary party and given it to the party membership, given how, I guess, it would be fair to say that the Conservative base or membership base is not really reflective of the British public at large. It's a older subset and with a certain particular outlook, probably closer to many of the things that Reform are offering than the broader British public. So therefore, the choice of leader and the mechanism of leader will be really important. I don't see Reform as being something which is going to permanently destroy the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party has been historically the most successful party in British electoral politics, but it certainly has challenges, and what they do next will really decide how long it takes them to map out a path back into power, to rebuild trust, to rebuild confidence, and ultimately to damage the Labour Party that's now in government. The opportunities for the Conservatives are that Labour's inherited a very difficult economic situation. There's not nearly enough growth to fund many of the things that they would like to do in the early stages of the government. Maybe we'll come on to talk about that in due course. And this is really going to be a very challenging economic period for the UK. So opportunities for the Conservatives, they're certainly not finished, but they've had a really bad election.
You mentioned the temptation to go towards the right. From an outside point of view, it looks like certainly the right is the dominant kind of force within the Conservatives. Is there anybody that's kind of more moderate? I mean, I don't know whether this is jokingly, but people have been throwing around names like Rory Stewart, for example, making a comeback. I think he didn't deny it on a recent podcast. But who could they look at if they want to take a more moderate kind of centre approach and a leader that reflects maybe some of those political views?
So, you know, so they're stuck with who they've had re-elected. Ultimately, the only way to get anyone else into Parliament will be through a by-election. And those come few and far between. And even when they do come, to put a leadership hopeful back into Parliament through a by-election, first, you have to win it. And secondly, it's not necessarily a safe seat, even if you do win it, given that it was one held by another party prior to the particular by-election. So they've lost a number of people. Defence Secretary lost their seat. The Leader of the House lost their seat. All people who could have been leadership candidates. Jeremy Hunt, who would be from the more Cameron-style side of the Conservative Party, did get re-elected, although he was under pressure in a constituency just south of London. And Suella Braverman, who would be very much of the right, as would Priti Patel, both retained their seats. So both sides have candidates. The difficulty for the Conservatives is getting a party that's on the same page and isn't divided in order to take whatever course they choose to take. But going to the right is not going to succeed. Neither of those right-wing or further right candidates that I've mentioned potentially for leadership are going to be the successfully able to out Farage, for example. So I don't see that happening. There has been some discussion within some Conservative circles about how they might work with Farage. And it wouldn't be without possibility that at least a conversation's taking place within some elements of the Conservative Party about how to bring Reform closer and potentially to bring inside a broader Conservative tent. But that would mean very much movement to the right and, again, further vacation of the centre ground for Labour. So not the best strategy longer term for the Conservatives, but these decisions and judgments tend to happen with a lurch following a poor election result like this, where instead of reflecting on what we could have done better, i.e. the Conservatives, from their own perspective, they look to what others have done and think that that's where their problems are best solved.
You mentioned Labor's ambitious agenda and how it doesn't really fit the reality bill, right? I mean, the funds just simply aren't there. Could you break that down a little bit for us? What is the Labor Party walking into, and what are we likely to see from sort of a political or policy, economic, social perspective over the next little while?
So it's interesting. They've tried to avoid big promises, and it's really been about economic stability. They won't set out their economic plans, although there is a speech today by the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, the new Finance Minister. But they'll be waiting for forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility. So we may have the first budget, more likely sort of October, November. There is a big commitment on a Great British Energy, government-owned energy company. They're looking to fund this through a windfall tax on oil and gas. Again, this is to tackle, in part, the cost of living crisis, as it's been termed in the UK, energy prices being one particular problem. They have again circled back on non-domiciled tax avoidance issues, and they're looking to introduce some policy reform in that area. There has historically been a tax break on private school fees, which is for those who are fee-paying education in the UK being free for the vast majority of children other than those who choose to pay for a particular select education. It's not been subject to value-added tax, or GST as we call it in Singapore, and that tax break is to be removed, and the Labour, I think they priced it around $1.5 billion that they think will be able to be reinvested back into state schools. They are committed to building 1 to 1.5 million new homes. They want to reduce health waiting lists by introducing or making available 40,000 new appointments across the country per week, which will inevitably involve weekends and so on. I think we touched previously on waiting lists being something like triple what they were in 2010. They will scrap the Conservative Party's Rwanda policy, which was to send asylum seekers overseas pending the outcome of their application. The Labour have said, made noises around community policing and recruitments on that front, as well as recruiting 1 to 1,500 new teachers. And one of the main themes of what Keir Starmer said about what Labour are going to do in their first phase, and I guess right through their term, and this is likely to be a full-term parliament, given the size of the majority, is politicians and Labour reintroducing or embracing a sense of service. And they talk about service first, country first, party second, and so on. In terms of foreign policy, there'll be no change on Ukraine. NATO summit is this week. That's one of Starmer's first big global opportunities. They have Labour undertaken to introduce a strategic defence review. And then next week will be the Queen's speech, which I've already mentioned, where they'll introduce their legislative priorities for the first 12 months. There is proposals around nationalising the railways, planning reform, which inhibits, in their view, I'm looking at economic growth, but also housing in certain areas where there's restrictions, an employment rights bill. And in foreign policy, again, I mentioned Ukraine, there'll be no change. They also have to really navigate the issue of Gaza. And it's something which costs them a few seats at this election. I think it was 4 seats went to independents who were campaigning against Labour on a pro-Gaza ticket. 2 in Leicester, 1 cost a shadow cabinet member who would have become a government minister in all likelihood on Labour appointing their ministers in Leicester. Jeremy Corbyn is an independent, of course, in Islington, and I believe 2 other candidates. So that's something, again, which is more difficult for Labour because they will have internal noise in Parliament on that particular issue, where they are seen to be not sufficiently sympathetic to the Palestinians.
You mentioned Nigel Farage finally succeeding in his efforts to enter into Parliament. His Reform UK party got, I think, over 3 million votes, around 14.3% of the total vote, and they were only able to win 5 seats, which compared to the Liberal Democrats, who got around about 12% and won 70 seats. Obviously, you mentioned the UK voting system being first past the post. Obviously, this is the reason for that. Are we likely to see a debate around changing the voting system? Because regardless of, I suppose, who you support or your political colours, this does not seem all that fair to any outside observer. Also, if you can just talk a little bit about why Reform UK did so well, what drove their success?
Yeah, sure. The interesting point around the electoral system and any move to a more proportional system, the UK succeeded in terms of stable government and the absence of coalitions over this past century, as I referenced at the outset. Because of the first past the post system, it tends to produce single party governments, which of course are more effective at governing on the agenda that they've gone to the electorate and sought a mandate on. In terms of coalitions, there's obviously greater scope for smaller parties with a more bespoke manifesto or agenda, getting disproportionate number of their policies introduced by virtue of a larger party needing their support, which hasn't always been the view as a positive, or been viewed as a positive in the UK. The crucial party that would have to be behind electoral reform would be the Labour Party. The Labour Party just got 63% of the votes, 63% of the seats on a 34% vote share. So really, the question is, could you persuade those members of Parliament for Labour that this would be the right time to have a proper debate on electoral reform? My sense is no. And even those who say it's really difficult for smaller parties to get a foothold under the first past the post system, an opponent of electoral reform could easily point to the success of reform in getting a number of seats, and the success of the Greens in securing 4 seats, which is their best return ever. And even the Liberal Democrats and being able to go from 9 to into the 70s as a reason why we don't necessarily need electoral reform. The success of reform at this election, yes, their vote share was high, but their seats outcome was low. But that's because of the type of campaign that they engaged in, where a party like the Liberal Democrats would be targeting all of their resource on key seats where they knew they might have an opportunity of winning. That was much more difficult for reform because their vote was spread out across the country. They hadn't necessarily tested that vote, and they couldn't go to the electorate and say, within your constituency, our party got second place last time. If you want to remove the Conservative, second place last time was the Liberal Democrats or Labour. They are best placed to defeat a Conservative at this election, and therefore, if you want a change in government, this is how you vote. And that's very often how these things are played out at constituency level within the UK. And it's also why Farage, in the run-up, maybe the final 2 weeks of the election, was very keen to point out that the Reform Party on some polling had drawn neck and neck with the Conservatives. In other words, they could replace the Conservatives in some area. Yes, they're unfortunate in terms of what might look like a percentage carried across to directly the number of seats, but other parties fought differently within the system that we have, which might look less successful in terms of the vote share, but it's done in a way to maximise the outcomes within the system. Reform and Farage are UK populism. They are promises without responsibility. They're not afraid to test boundaries on controversial statements, in particular on immigration, and they are very keen to play on fear of crime, fear of immigration, many of those populist policies that we hear, for example, from Trump in the US, and they heavily use social media because they are keen to circumvent what might be a sense or truth filter of conventional or mainstream media. And they want to beam their play on fear and sometimes prejudice directly to those most likely to be receptive to that particular message. So they're the type of party which are more likely to succeed through social media. Social media connect these people who may think that they themselves have fringe opinions, and that it gives that opinion credibility, and they can create these echo chambers and so on, where this particular populism in the UK form starts to gain momentum and so on. But they don't have this type of professional party we've seen like the Lib Dems have.
One of the notable characteristics, Rodney, of the UK elections was the low voter turnout. Only 60% of eligible voters participated in the election. It's one of the lowest turnouts in British history since really the late 1800s. Why is that? And what does it mean for the major parties and the major players?
So there's been some expert opinion which has said the low voter turnout was in part a stay-at-home conservatives who were cross with the government but not willing to hold their nose and vote Labour or whatever alternative, the option that they may have considered. But I think there were clear other options, both in Reform and the Lib Dems and so on. And to an extent, and we'll see as greater analysis is done on this election in the coming weeks, to an extent, the fact that the outcome of the election was so clearly laid out in the polling, as you guys opened with, the polls have been very clear for a very long time. There'd been no real shift, and the outcome was, in a sense, a foregone conclusion. To what extent that has impacted on turnout is something of interest, and I'd like to see, and I haven't seen yet, some more detailed analysis of that particular issue or what the causation around that might actually be. I guess there'll be some focus groups and potentially research done on those who chose not to vote at this election and their motivation and so on. Because I don't think it's as easy to say that it was a low turnout because Conservatives stayed at home because they were cross with the government, because there were alternatives. And even the most diehard Conservative would have been potentially tempted by Reform or even the Liberal Democrats, as I previously said. I think to an extent, and maybe a large extent, this low turnout is reflective of the fact that the election was seemed to be a foregone conclusion. And even if you look at how the Conservatives ran their own campaign in the latter stages of the election, they were running a line or a message of don't let Labour get a supermajority. And that in itself was one, an acknowledgement that they weren't going to win. Two, by the way, there isn't such a thing as a supermajority within the UK political system, but it was one, an acknowledgement they weren't going to win, and two, really an attempt at reducing the number of Labour voters who felt they needed to go out on election day to secure that win, because there's been some comparison with the Boris Johnson Corbyn election in 2019 and the fact that the Labour vote share was only up a couple of percentage points from that. But that was a much more polarised election where Reform weren't at play, Lib Dems weren't at play. There was those people who didn't want Boris Johnson to win that election, and there were those people who didn't want Jeremy Corbyn to win that election. And that was a polarised election with reason to go out and vote against the other, because the narrative wasn't that one was definitely going to win and it was a foregone conclusion.
Well, one place where Labour supporters came out in force was, of course, the traditional heartland of Labour in Scotland. The results, phenomenal for Labour, as you previously mentioned. What does this mean for the SNP? How do they come back from this, or are they going to end up being irrelevant in UK politics?
So it's interesting for the SNP because with devolution in the UK, devolution meaning there's a Scottish Parliament, there's a assembly, though it may now be called a Parliament in Wales, and there's an assembly in Northern Ireland where there is legislative capacity. There's an elected body who and a regional government who administrate certain layers of power within that region. The SNP are still in government in Scotland, so even losing a large number of members of parliament like they have might hit them financially, because there's research funding and so on that attaches to the number of MPs any political party has, as well as staffing allowances, the ability to really serve a constituency with Rolls-Royce service, with elected people at different levels and so on. So it may impact on that, but it doesn't remove the SNP from being able to be front and centre of the minds of Scottish voters. The SNP had also suffered from scandals in recent times. You may recall that the First Minister, not the most recent, but one before that, Nicola Sturgeon, who'd been there for some time, resigned last year. Issue around her husband, who was chief executive of the SNP, loaning money to the party, some 100,000. Questions about how aware she was of this. Her successor was then Hamza Yousaf, who lasted just over a year as leader. He terminated a coalition agreement with the Green Party, which was the devolved government administration, the basis of it, and ended up facing a vote of no confidence, triggering resignation. And, you know, even after he took over last May, by June, his predecessor, Nicola Sturgeon, had been arrested and interviewed following a separate investigation or an additional investigation into some £600,000 of party donations. And she wasn't charged in relation to that, but her husband was charged in April this year, which again is a number of weeks before this election. And that's a police investigation and now, you know, issue prosecution following charge is also ongoing. The other thing that the SNP got themselves into some difficulty on was they invested some time and effort on trans issues. They introduced a gender recognition bill in during the last term of government that was then said to conflict with UK national law in terms of equality law. The Scottish government were then going to challenge the UK national government. UK government sought to block this regional legislation and royal assent. And then the this is during Nicola Sturgeon's time prior to her resignation in February of last year. And then the SNP found themselves supporting the placing of a convicted rapist in a women's prison, at which time the Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon referred to the prisoner in question or the convicted sex offender in question with gender terminology that suited that individual, and it caused a large degree of controversy. But even then, her you know successor left after just over a year. The current leader, who was someone who was involved as deputy leader back at an earlier stage and been, you know, not been given the opportunity to replace Sturgeon when she stood down, had only been in place a number of weeks. So for many reasons, and for, again, longevity of incumbency, the SNP were always going to face a point when they became less popular because they haven't delivered on independence. They're delivering day-to-day government. They can't get it right all the time. They can't always blame the Conservatives and funding at a national level in terms of the Scottish component of the budget and so on. But voters in Scotland ultimately saw this as a national election and chose to vote to get the Conservatives out, and Labour to them was the most natural vehicle in order to do so. So I think the real test for the Scottish National Party is how they perform in the next Scottish election, to see whether this is a domino effect of, you know, they lose a substantial number of MPs, which is, you know, it was a spectacular decline in their Westminster, London, UK national parliamentary numbers, but whether that actually knocks on and Labour make further gains at the devolved level within the Scottish Parliament, that will be the real test of how difficult the SNP's brand or how damaged the SNP's brand has become over recent times, and what they do between now and that election in order to rebuild trust and confidence in them. One thing that this will be used as, though, the icon nationally, is a reason not to have a further Scottish referendum in the short term on independence. Often the SNP will use these types of Westminster elections as a, if you want a further referendum on independence, you need to vote SNP. We need to send a signal to UK national government that it's time for a further referendum. Any argument on that line has failed miserably at this election. So I don't see a further Scottish referendum in the short term. And I think the SNP's real test in terms of what is the decline will be within the next Scottish Parliament elections.
Rodney, you've done an amazing job as always to unpack all of the various different elements of these election results and what they mean. Thank you very much for your time, and we hope to get you back on and discuss all things UK politics, and we still need to talk about rugby at some point as well, women's rugby in particular. I know you're passionate and very heavily involved in that, so maybe next time we get you back for something different to elections and politics. But thank you for your time. It's been fantastic talking to you.
Thanks, guys. Great to talk as always.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.